So we'll move on to United States versus Manava. Mr. Neumer?
May it please the Court. The United States Supreme Court has made clear that a guilty verdict must be set aside where the verdict is legally supportable on one grounds, but not in another, and it is impossible to tell which grounds the jury selected. That is exactly the most glaring problem presented by the case before the Court today. The government's indictment of Mr. Manava was predicated on his alleged chargeability under Indiana's vicarious sexual gratification and child solicitation statute. Neither the jury verdict nor the verdict form, however, of the jury instructions required the jury to determine unanimously which Indiana statute Mr. Manava could have been charged with. Therefore, it's entirely possible, as the government concedes, that some of the jury convicted Mr. Manava, believing him to have been chargeable with child solicitation, while some of the jury convicted based on the belief that he could have been convicted with child solicitation. In other words, the record simply fails to indicate whether the jurors ever unanimously agreed as to either predicate offense. Now, the constitutional requirement of jury unanimity is particularly critical here, given that Mr. Manava could not have been charged as a matter of Indiana state law with vicarious sexual gratification. Indiana case law demonstrates that the vicarious sexual gratification statute's lack of a belief provision renders it inapplicable to sting operation cases like this one. Thus, it is not only possible that the jury had reached a split verdict as to the predicate offenses, it's possible that the jury unanimously agreed as to the legally impermissible predicate offense. In either case, and because the record does not reveal the basis for a verdict, the controlling authority here holds that the conviction here must be vacated.
Are you saying it's the vicarious one that doesn't permit a sting?
That's,
or permit a conviction for a sting?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Doesn't say anything about belief.
Exactly. The vicarious sexual gratification, unlike the child solicitation statute, does not contain a provision as to, in this case, the defendant's belief as to the age of the person he's communicating with. And Indiana state law is clear. In Applin, Indiana v. Applin, a recently decided case, the court, in a sting operation case just like this one, held where defendant was charged and convicted of sexual misconduct with a minor and child solicitation. The court overturned defendant's conviction on the sexual misconduct of a minor statute because it did not contain a belief provision, unlike the child solicitation statute. The court noted in Applin that the proper charge was the child solicitation statute precisely because it had a belief provision. In a 2001 case in Kemp, the court considered a previous version of the child solicitation statute. That previous version of the child solicitation statute also did not have a belief provision. There in Kemp, the court affirmed the trial court's dismissal of the child solicitation charges because it was a sting operation, once again like this one, where an adult was posing as a minor online, and the court said that the child solicitation statute, lacking the belief provision, it was subsequently amended, is only criminalizes conduct that's directed toward a child. The court in Kemp then went on to provide a sort of a hint to the legislature that if you want to cover situations, sting operation cases, that they should amend the language to include a belief provision. Subsequently, the Indiana legislature did amend the child solicitation. They did add a belief provision as to that statute, but there is no such belief provision in the vicarious sexual gratification statute. So we know that the Indiana state legislature is aware of the differences and is aware of the importance of a belief provision such as this one, but they simply chose not to amend the statute.
This is not the same argument as your argument about the about the duplicitousness of the of the charge, right? This is a separate argument.
The fact that Mr. Manava could not have been charged with vicarious sexual gratification leads us to a situation where we have a a conviction that is, there's an invalid basis for a conviction and a valid basis for a conviction. We do not contest that Mr. Manava could have been convicted under child solicitation, that the jury could have concluded that he could have been charged with child solicitation. But we are in a situation where we have the vicarious sexual gratification, which he could not have been charged with, and we have the child solicitation, which he could have been charged with. And the Supreme Court, the Yates Doctrine, holds that where we have...
Wouldn't your argument be the same if he could have been convicted of both? Because I thought your argument is that, you know, half the jury might have thought he was guilty of one and innocent of the other, and the other half. Wouldn't that be the same even if...
I agree. And certainly under Richardson, we certainly argue as well that we need that the jury was required to be unanimous as to which of these predicate offenses. Even if both bases were valid, still we need to have a jury unanimity under Richardson, because the question of whether Mr. Manava could be charged or violated in the government's language, not in the statutory language, is under Richardson, that is a phrase that has independent legal significance. The requirement that the jury apply Mr. Manava's conduct, apply legal standard to Mr. Manava's conduct, is a language that has independent legal significance, which the Supreme Court held in Richardson must be found unanimously by a jury. Therefore, we agree with the court that even if both these grounds were valid, the jury would still should have been required to find unanimously which predicate offense Mr. Manava could have been charged with. But the simple fact is, neither the jury verdict form nor the trial court never instructed the jury that it had to find unanimously as to which Indiana state offense Mr. Manava could have been charged with. And therefore, the government, in its contention in its brief, that the unanimity about which Indiana sex crimes law the defendant violated was not necessary is wrong, as is its related contention that a conviction could properly lie where half of the jurors concluded that the defendant violated Indiana's vicarious sexual gratification law and the other half concluded that he violated Indiana's child solicitation law. And under the government's logic, we could have a defendant convicted in federal court under 2422B, even when he couldn't be convicted in state court, under the same offenses that the federal charge is based on. And that conclusion simply doesn't make sense in our case. So what we have, in addition, we have an indication, recent case law in the Second Circuit, supports the idea that Yates applies to 2422B cases. In United States versus Joseph, another sting operation, well, it was a private citizen, but it was essentially a sting operation case like this one. The Second Circuit concluded that the jury instructions were legally impermissible with respect to the word entice in 2422B, and they were legally permissible with respect to the word persuade. Therefore, you had two grounds for conviction, persuading or enticing. Persuading was legally permissible. Enticing was not legally permissible. The Second Circuit held that the defendant's conviction must be vacated under 2422B because it was impossible to determine which grounds the jury selected. This court in Joseph even considered a plain error review in a situation where a defendant had failed to preserve the error, as is the case here, and they noted that even if the jury instruction error had not been preserved, the test for affirming, notwithstanding submission to a jury of an invalid legal basis for conviction, is not whether there is conclusive evidence of guilt under the valid basis. A verdict must be set aside where it's supportable on one ground, but not in another, and is impossible to tell which ground the jury selected. That's precisely the case here. We have a valid basis and an invalid legal basis, and there is no way of knowing which basis the jury selected here, or whether even the jury was unanimous.
You already said that three times.
In addition here, it should be noted that the language of 2422B also raises constitutional concerns. Statute states in relevant part, whoever using any facility or means of interstate commerce knowingly persuades, induces, entices, or coerces any individual who has not attained the age of 18 years to engage in any sexual activity for which any person can be charged with a criminal offense.
Yeah, but didn't the district judge take care of that in the instruction?
Well, the Supreme Court has said that with respect to structural error, which we feel a lessening of the beyond a reasonable doubt standard cannot be corrected through instruction to the jury. So,
but it's just a badly worded statute, and if the judge clarifies it, I mean, I could understand how you might, not in this case, but you could have someone who complained that the statute, because of the use of the word chargeable, somehow, you know, misled or something like that. But as far as confusing the jury, it seems to me if the judge gives a clear instruction, in effect defining chargeable as violated, doesn't that protect the defendant?
Well, once again, we would submit that the structural error that's present and the fact that the statute is badly worded and the rule of lenity dictates that statutes that are badly worded or ambiguous should be interpreted in favor of the defendant. Certainly here we could have a situation where the jury...
But you want it to interpret it, or you want to condemn it as unconstitutional, but I don't see what the prejudice is to a defendant as long as the judge instructs that the government has to prove that there was a violation.
With respect to prejudice, especially here where the government made repeated references to a third uncharged offense, rape, in conjunction with the ambiguous language of the statute, certainly the jury, it would be understandable if they were confused as to what standard or even what charges.
You're in your rebuttal time.
Okay.
Let me ask you, no one made any reference, though, to any other burden of proof other than proof beyond a reasonable doubt, right?
That's correct.
And when you look at the context of when the court is instructing the jury on the elements and finding whether the propositions have been proven or not proven, that's the second time that the court talks about the burden of proof in addition to talking about it before he even gets into the elements. Isn't that right?
That's correct.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks. Sorry.
I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Mr. Radcliffe?
Good morning. I'm Tom Radcliffe. I represent the United States of America in this case. If the defendant wants to make this case about Indiana law and the predicate offenses for this federal statute for 2422B, the government is willing, more than willing, to take up that issue first because it does seem to be the centerpiece of the defendant's argument. But the government... hastens to note that the defendant respectfully is misreading Indiana law. He's misreading the Kemp decision.
Forget that for a moment. I think the more serious issue is this duplicitousness. So suppose you had a federal statute which says that anybody on federal property, Indian reservation or this courthouse or someone, anyone who commits a state crime is guilty of a federal offense. And would it be your view that the government could say to the jury, well, look, we think this defendant committed 12 state crimes, and we'd like you to think about those, and, you know, as long as one of you thinks that... it was crime number one, another one you think is number 11, and so on, then you can convict. Would that be permissible?
Judge Posner, I recognize the
answer my question, please.
It would be permissible, Your Honor, if the court concludes under Richardson that those state offenses are the means.
That can't be right, right? Because you could have a situation in which on each of the 12 state crimes, 11 of the jurors thought the defendant was innocent and one thought he was guilty, right? And then they'd all add up and they'd say, well, each of us, you know, thinks he's guilty of one crime, so therefore he's guilty of the federal offense. Is that your position?
Judge, as I was about to say...
Answer my question, yes or no.
It is our position that if the court...
Answer my question about...
Yes,
I asked
no.
you
That's
a hypothetical
no.
case.
It doesn't make any difference what you say. Just say yes or no. Come on.
Bob, Your Honor, I'm sorry. Can you repeat the question at this point? Are you asking... If I understand
yes.
your question correctly, you're asking...
You want me to repeat it or you want to repeat it? You have your choice.
I'll try to repeat it, Your Honor, and you can tell me if I'm doing it justice. You're asking me if there are 12 predicate offenses that are all state court violations, and the government throws all of those out and says that fits in to this single element of the federal offense. Please find that they violated that single element of the federal offense.
At least one of those.
At least one of those. Then, yes, it would be. It does seem to be an absurd result.
That is a preposterous result. You're quite right.
But
can't
Your
be
Honor,
the law.
But,
it can't be the less ridiculous.
But, Your Honor, the issue here in this case, then, respectfully,
wait
is...
Wait a second. This is the government's position? This is the Justice Department's position? You can have a situation in which 1/12 of the jury believes that someone is guilty of an offense and that's enough to... convict him?
No, Your Honor. What I've been trying to get to is our concession that it certainly would have been better in this case.
That's not a concession to what would have been better. That's not a concession. You deal with this. Your position is a statute which says, it doesn't have to be 12, it could be any state crime. Then you list 100 state crimes and you say to the jury, 100 state crimes, you know, if you decide that and you don't have to be unanimous about which crime, but if you decide that he's committed one of these crimes, then he's committed the federal offense. That's the Justice Department's position.
Well, Your Honor, I believe in that situation, if you're saying that if we're throwing out there, if you believe that he's committed at least one of these crimes, then you're suggesting that there would be a request for unanimity. But I think the example you gave before is the problematic example where you have...
The question is not whether they can find... One thing that all 12 find that one thing.
Correct.
That's what has to be. Is that your position?
That's what should be done. Yes, I recognize.
That's your position.
Judge, our position.
The jury wasn't told you that 12 of you have to find either the vicarious or the solicitation or both. So you could have a situation: 6 find vicarious, innocent of solicitation; 6 find solicitation, innocent of vicarious. And in my case, you can have a situation, 1 finds him guilty of state crime 1, 1 of state crime 2, 1 of state crime 3, and that would suffice for conviction under your view, wouldn't it?
Under our view, Your Honor, that the state offenses
yes no.
are the mere means.
Yes or no, please.
Yes, it would, Your Honor.
Well, that's ridiculous.
And
because that makes complete hash of any kind of unanimity conception of the role of the jury.
Well, Your Honor, under this court's decision in Jackson, when it comes to deciding on which date a firearm was possessed, for example, between the 12th of July, I believe in that case,
sure,
versus the 15th of July.
It doesn't matter which date it's possessed on, but it does matter whether the jury thinks this person is guilty of a crime or not guilty of a crime. And if 11/12 of the jury thinks that he's innocent of every single crime, and you nevertheless he's convicted of the federal offense, that makes a hash out of a unanimity requirement.
It does, Your Honor, and that's why I've been trying to say the government in this case believes that the court does not have to address this issue because although the court has pointed out, I agree, an absurd example that is very problematic, in this case there was no opportunity to correct the problem.
Yes, there was. There could have been a jury verdict form, because you agree, you say that it should have been clearly identified to the jury that they had to pick either one, just like under the continuing criminal enterprise statute. The various continuing criminal enterprises, the various acts are listed in the indictment. They're listed in the verdict form. The jury checks it. And then we know we don't have this problem of the split 6-6. So you know that's the way it should have been done, correct?
Judge Williams, absolutely. I agree with you. The point I was trying to make is that the defendant did not give the court or the government. I was one of the two lawyers on the case, Your Honor, trial lawyers.
Why didn't you ask?
Judge, it's an issue that escaped us. It's an issue that escaped the district court. It's an issue that escaped the defense attorney.
All right. If it is, so you have to have another trial.
Why did the defendant pay? I mean, there are some things that are just plain error. And here, I'm not buying what you're trying to sell, that, you know, it's passed everybody by. So then sometimes we have to redo things.
Well, Judge Williams, as this court found this summer in Gibson, with respect to the murder for hire statute, when the analysis there was, gee, does the murder for hire statute require a unanimity finding with respect to certain means, or is the unanimity requirement going to elements of the offense?
This is not means. This is whether he look. Your means distinction is really weak. Because, look, the federal crime is derivative of two state crimes. And if the jury doesn't agree that he is not unanimous on one of the state crimes, there's no basis for thinking that this person is guilty of anything, right?
Judge, I recognize that in the absence of a special verdict form on that, we cannot know precisely,
and that's the verdict form was improper, and you should have realized that, and you should have asked for the proper form.
But that on a plain error review, which is where we are now,
right.
When there is no settled case law on this, in fact, the government is unaware of any Richardson analysis.
It's perfectly clear, because, look, you admitted it's absurd, right? So what do you need a case? Some things are so absurd you don't even have cases on.
Judge, I acknowledge that your example with 12 different state offenses would be absurd. But the reason that it's
the same case, you can't have a case where half the jurors think he's innocent and half are guilty and he's convicted.
Judge, let me tell you why I think it's less ridiculous in this case, and in fact not ridiculous in this case. We had offense conduct in this case, a variety of offense conduct in those chats in which the defendant...
Why did you throw in the vicarious stuff? You had to solicit... It's like you're having 8 pages of, you know, obscene brief with all this bold-facing stuff as if we were some jury of prudes or something and have to be shocked about this case. And you're all this business of screaming rape at the jury when it's not a rape case, it's overreaching.
Judge, with respect to the chats in the brief, the defendant in his opening brief does a one-page factual summary in which he says...
Bold-faced obscenities in a brief. Anyway, forget that. That's not the issue.
Judge, the point I was trying to make, however, is that in this case we have the same offense conduct, meaning the defendant asking...
Why is there vicarious stuff in there? Well, you have the solicitation. Why weren't you content with that?
Are you asking me why we included a predicate offense of vicarious sexual gratification in addition to the child solicitation?
That's screwing up your case, right.
I don't have a good answer for you on that, Judge.
Seemed like a good idea at the time, is what you're saying.
I'm sorry, Judge
Bell? It seemed like a good idea at the time.
It did.
In retrospect, it doesn't seem so bright.
But let me tell you this, and I know that I'm getting the warning light here. The point I was trying to make again is that the offense conduct of trying to get Gracie F-13 to masturbate, trying to get her to touch herself, that violates both the vicarious sexual gratification statute and the child solicitation statute.
Well, it applies to stings, of course. That's a question.
Well, that's the point I started to make when I got up here, Judge. I need to give the court one site that is not in any of the briefs, and that is...
Well, you need to submit that, you know, in a Rule 28J.
Well, Judge, this is I'm certainly willing to do that, but this is something that comes up as a result of...
You have to do it.
May I address then the defendants...
You have to follow it up with a letter. Do you understand that?
I absolutely will, Judge Posner. Of course, I understand that. The defendant in his brief cites Alpin and says that Alpin holds, as a matter of Indiana law, quote-unquote, that the defendant can't attempt to violate the Indiana attempted sexual misconduct with a minor statute if there is an undercover officer. That is, who is chatting. That is not what Alpin stands for. The defendant is wrong on that. Alpin, I will acknowledge, is not a clearly worded opinion. However, in footnote 4 in Alpin, the court says, you know what the problem here is? The state charged the defendant with attempting sexual misconduct with Dan Klassen, police officer, adult, not with the undercover officer's pseudonym. So there was a factual...
Did you cite Alpin in your brief?
No, Your Honor. Alpin is something that the defendant brought up in his reply brief. to buttress his claim that the vicarious sexual gratification statute can't support the charge here. The problem, however, is that there is controlling authority, which is Loeffner v. State, 769 Northeast 2nd, 1147.
Go a little slower. What is this case?
Skimming over, Judge, in planning to submit it in writing. Loeffner v. State, 769 Northeast 2nd, 1147. That's an Indiana Court of Appeals case from 2002 in which the court, in the context of the previous version of the child solicitation statute, before the Indiana legislature had written in the language saying, or the person believes that the victim to be under 14 years old, the court in Loeffner said that that statute, the prior version, absolutely does apply.
Did Loeffler overrule Applin?
No, Alpin came later, but the defendant cites Alpin mistakenly again for the proposition that the vicarious sexual gratification statute can't be used in the context of an undercover sting operation. He says that Alpin stands for legal impossibility on that. That is not what Alpin stands for, first of all, but Loeffner from 6 years before.
What is wrong with his quotation from Alpin on page 12?
His quotation is correct, Judge. The problem is this: if you read the ruling carefully, Alpin relies on the charging defect, the fact that the state charged the defendant with specifically trying to engage in sexual misconduct with a minor, but in the charging document they listed that minor as police officer Dan Klassen. They used his name, and that the problem was you can't attempt to have sex with an adult when you are being charged with attempting sexual misconduct with a minor. The statute doesn't work in that case. That's all Alpin is saying, and footnote 4 in Alpin makes it clear. Footnote 4 says Indiana has a general attempt provision, and if the state had proceeded under that, there could be no defense that, oh, well, it wasn't really a kid, so please let me off. And that's what Loeffner stands for. That's a decision that's not cited, as I said, in any of the briefs, but Loeffner directly refutes the defendant's claim that any Indiana statute, especially the vicarious sexual gratification statute, can't work in this situation. That is simply not Indiana law. Judge, seeing that my time has expired, I will sit down.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Ratliff. So, Mr. Neumer, do you have anything further?
Your Honors, I think the key issue here has been identified, that the inclusion of...
Then you want to talk us out of it?
No, Your Honors. I would just like to point out that with respect to the plain error view and the question of whether the law is settled here, the Richardson standard that a jury must be unanimous as to the elements of a criminal conviction but not the means is certainly settled here, and the plain language of these statutes under Indiana law, the belief provision and the lack of belief provision, is also clear on the face of it. So for the reasons articulated here today and for the reasons in our brief, we respectfully request that Mr. Manava's conviction be vacated and that this matter be remanded to the trial court for further proceedings.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Neumer, and we thank Mr. Ratliff also.